From Welcome Villain Films, the studio that brought you the horror hit Malum, as well as Beaten to Death and Hunter Killer, comes their newest nightmare, Mind, Body, Spirit, now available on digital. Directed by Alex Haynes and Matthew Miranda, and produced by Dan Asma, Mind, Body, Spirit follows Anya, an aspiring yoga influencer, as she embarks on a ritual practice left behind by her estranged grandmother. What starts as a spiritual self-help guide quickly evolves into something much more sinister, as Anya becomes increasingly obsessed with the mysterious power of the practice. She unwittingly unleashes an otherworldly entity that begins to take control of her life and her videos. Now, Anya must race to unlock the truth before her descent into madness threatens to consume her mind, body, and spirit. During its festival tour, with stops at Chattanooga Film Festival and the Unnamed Footage Festival, Mind, Body, Spirit garnered praise from critics who call it a found footage version of Hereditary and a knockout found footage horror movie for the live stream era. Experience the first ever yoga-themed found footage horror film, and don't miss the film viewers have called extremely frightening and upsetting. Available now on digital anywhere you rent or buy movies online, including Prime Video and Apple Plus.
And welcome back to Little Cuts, our weekly minisode where we dig into the things that we've been watching and, I believe, playing. I'm Terry.
And I'm Mary Beth, and also reading. This week we're chatting about a surprising adaptation, the latest from Studio Ghibli, realistic murders and meta storytelling, fascinating narratives, and...
Ritualistic.
What did I say?
Realistic.
Ritualistic murders. Indiana Jones in hell.
It can be realistic, too. You're right, Kate.
I'm obviously... We're recording this the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, and obviously my brain... Going from coming back from Japan and then having jet lag and then having it be Thanksgiving, I am, like... I don't know what's happening. It's great. I'm just here. But it's good. We're here. We're here to talk about movies and stuff. And I hope everyone had a good Thanksgiving and didn't have too hard of a time with family. And you could have a little bit of relaxation time. And if you had to work, I'm so sorry that capitalism is garbage.
Yeah. Exactly. exactly.
And on that note, surprising adaptation.
Yeah, so... I can't really talk too much about this because I don't want to spoil it. However, I've been watching the animated Scott Pilgrim Takes Off.
Oh, I have to watch that.
I say it's surprising because while it starts as a pure adaptation, it's not a pure adaptation.
Okay.
And it does something very surprising. I was scrolling on TikTok earlier in the week, and I saw someone doing a video saying that, like, Scott Pilgrim Takes Off is as if, like, oh gosh, what's his name? The writer of the...
Brian Lee O'Malley?
Brian Lee O'Malley. As if Brian Lee O'Malley has gone to therapy.
Good for him.
I cannot agree more with that, because if you are familiar with Scott Pilgrim, it's about Scott, who is in love with this manic pixie dreamboat girl named Ramona Flowers that rollerblades through his mind in a dream, and then he sees her in real life, becomes obsessed with her, discovers that she has 7 evil exes and must destroy them all to win her heart. And there's a lot of other weird things, like the fact that he's somewhat dating but not really a 17-year-old high school girl at the same time. Yeah. Yep. So there's a lot of, like, weird, awkward things that, like, you know, so here's the thing. I love the movie. I've never read the comic.
Okay.
But I love the movie, but I also love Edgar Wright a whole lot. I love the kinetic energy of the film. It's one of those things that's like, you look back on it and it's like, ooh, there is some weird things here. This show kind of goes about trying to correct it. And I really wish I could talk about it and really tell you why I'm really enjoying this. But I also don't want to spoil why I'm really enjoying this. So I will say that if you're a fan of the movie, this is sort of like an alternate telling of it. And okay. If you were like put off by some of the things in the movie and or the comic, because I'm guessing the comic is similar in that regard, this is a very surprising adaptation. And I will leave it at that.
Okay. Like, I went as Ramona Flowers for Halloween one year. Like, I dyed my hair blue. I loved the comics so much. Like, they were the... So, it's funny because those were the first comics to get me into comics. And that's how I found the local comic book store around here, Third Eye Comics. Cool. And that's how I found it, because I was looking for the next Scott Pilgrim, because I was reading them when they were still coming out. Like, it had... all of them hadn't come out yet. And so I was trying to find the fifth one, and they were the only place that had it. And then I have been going there ever since, and it's been really cool to see them expand. But, like, I have been a huge fan of Scott Pilgrim, and I loved the comic. But I also loved Ramona, because I felt a lot like Ramona. And, like, she is, like, a manic pixie dream girl, but I, like, definitely felt kind of like her. And I do think... I mean, maybe because of how I read the comics, but, like, Scott's always been such a dick. Like, he's never, to me, been, like, a sympathetic character, necessarily. Like, he's,
right.
I think, a really early example of toxic, like, we can get toxic masculinity in nerds, but making it a little bit more charming. But I do think that it is a really interesting early look at fuckboys. Especially fuckboys who think they're nice guys. So I'm excited to watch this, because it sounds like it might interrogate that way more than the original series did. But I do love that movie. Brie Larson singing Black Sheep by Metric. I mean, come on.
Iconic.
Iconic.
And that's the other thing I love.
One moment. I've got to check a pie real quick.
Perfect. Perfect. Thank you. Yeah, just leave it out.
I had to make sure the pie crust was cooked enough.
Listeners, literally the day before Thanksgiving is when we're recording this.
So, it's like the last big step in making this fucking pie, and it's done. Thank you, Steve. Anyway.
But speaking of, so the iconic performance of the Metric song, that I love that this brings back the entire cast of the movie.
Yeah, I do love that. I did know this, yes.
And because it is like 8 episodes of 20 to 30-ish minutes long in length each episode, we do get to see a lot more of the characters other than Scott in this, because we have more time to spend with Wallace, and we have more time to spend with young Neil. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot... I do think that there's some really interesting things here on top of some of the twists and turns that this series takes.
Hell yeah.
So I highly recommend it, particularly for those that are like, you know, I liked it, but that was a little weird.
Yeah.
Like, looking back on it, because it does do some very intriguing things with a very familiar narrative. So yeah, I really dug it. And it's on Netflix. The entire show is on Netflix right now. So go check it out.
Cool.
All right. So keeping in the animation realm, let's talk about Studio Ghibli. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, Studio Ghibli. So I was lucky enough to see the press screening of his latest film, The Boy and the Heron, which I believe is his first film in, I think, 10 years?
Dang.
Yeah, I believe it's 10 years. And I am a Studio Ghibli freak. I love all of his movies. Hayao Miyazaki is the man who founded Studio Ghibli. Done films like Spirited Away, Princess Mononoke, My Neighbor Totoro. Like, most people who know anime know about it because of Miyazaki, because of his work. And Spirited Away was like this big deal because it was the first animated movie to win. Hold on a second. I need to make sure that's right. But it won an award for the animation. And it's an absolutely incredible movie. And so Princess Mononoke is my personal favorite of his. But so this is his latest film. It's essentially, it's this latest film after The Wind Rises, which is like, was not, so Miyazaki's known for being very fantastical in his movies, but The Wind Rises was more of a drama about the guy who made airplanes they used as kamikaze planes in World War II, I believe. And a lot of his work grapples with World War II and does a lot of stuff with aviation, because I believe one of his parents worked in aviation. I can't fully remember, but this latest film is like a combination of Japanese historical drama and like A Spirited Away. And here, a young boy named Mahito moves with his dad to live with his stepmom after his mother has died tragically in a fire due to a bombing of Tokyo during World War II. And when he goes to where the stepmom lives, who's also his aunt, weird things start happening around the house, and a heron starts talking to him, and his stepmom disappears, and he must go find her. It is absolutely gorgeous. It's much sadder than a lot of his movies in terms of, like, it's much more melancholy, and it's very much about, like, the grieving process and, like, what it means to go through grief as a child. And a lot of Miyazaki's movies are very mature in that way, but this feels like he took Spirited Away and took a lot more of the whimsy out of it. Have you seen Spirited Away, Terry?
I've seen Spirited Away, Princess Mononoke, and Howl's Moving Castle.
Okay. So, like, in Spirited Away, where Chihiro is, like, going into the spirit world, and she's kind of, like, a selfish kid. Here, it's more about Mahito's healing journey as he's trying to grapple with his mom's passing. But also, there is a lot of whimsy, but it's split more into two parts than a lot of his movies are. And it was interesting because, like, it's not as, you know, he usually has a pretty brief introduction before it gets fully, like, whimsical. But here, it's much more, like, of a gradual build, and then it's just, like, super whimsical and nuts and, like, cosmic, and then it stops. And so the pacing is a little bit weird to me. And I saw the sub, the screening image, it wasn't dubbed. So I was wondering if there were some things that maybe might be better translated in the dub. I'm not sure, because the dub has Robert Pattinson as one of the voices, as like a heron.
I was going to say.
I know. I was a little bit bummed.
He voices the heron, right?
Yeah. I was bummed not to hear that. But Steve wants to see it. So we're going to see it again when it's out in theaters. But I'm still percolating on how I feel about it. It felt so much more somber in a way that's very interesting. But also, apparently, it is the most expensive film ever produced in Japan. I just learned this.
Oh.
Huh. Fascinating.
It's a long one for an animated, too. It's 2 hours and 4 minutes.
Yeah, all of his movies are long.
Are they? Yeah. I'm not as familiar with his work. Like I said, I've only seen those three.
Yeah, Princess Mononoke is pretty long, so is Spirited Away. All of his stuff is pretty long, because it's usually pretty involved. Like, a lot of his work, and it's interesting, because a lot of his work, Howl's Moving Castle deals with war. Yes, Grave of the Fireflies was Studio Ghibli, but it wasn't directed by... Yes, it was produced by Studio Ghibli, but it was directed by Isao Takahata. Yeah, so he didn't direct it. But yeah, a lot of Miyazaki's work has to do with war and, like, processing grief, but in more fantastical environments. And his work has gotten more and more moved away from being as fantastical and more like, hey, life sucks, in, like, a very interesting way, but also with some hope in it. And I think it's, like, it's interesting because it's, like, him processing his own trauma as a kid around all of this stuff. And it's also very interesting to watch The Boy and the Heron. It's very different. It's very, very different circumstances. But watching how war tears people apart and, like, the, like, civilian consequences of war. Obviously, World War II and us bombing Japan. Well, I don't believe in any of that. But, like, I know it's very different circumstances. But still, like, this film does look a lot at, like, the civilian toll that war takes and how it wreck so many people, which is, like, unfortunately very prescient right now.
Definitely relevant.
Yeah. So but it's out December 8th in theaters. I just need to keep sitting on it, which is always how I feel about his movies. Like, his movies have so much going on that sometimes, like, I need to percolate on them and see them again before I fully, like, digest what's being said. It's beautiful. It's, like, absolutely beautiful. The music is incredible. It's, like, an absolutely gorgeous movie. I just don't know how I feel about the whole story execution yet.
Yeah, I do think, because, like, when I first saw Princess Mononoke, I was was like, I don't get what all the hubbub is about. And then I watched it again a little when I was a little older, and I was like, oh, I'm getting it now. And so then I felt the same way about Spirited Away and Howl's Moving Castle, where like the first time I watched it, I was like, there's a lot happening. I'm not 100% sure how I feel about it. And then you start to like think about it and it percolates, and then you realize how good it is. So I'm curious if that'll be similar with this one.
Yeah.
Because is this supposed to be his last, or did he retract
that? He always says that. Like, he says that all the time. I mean, he says it's going to be his last, but I don't know if I believe that. You know what I mean? Like, he said it a couple times, mm-hmm. and I'm like, I'll believe it when I see it. I don't think he's going to fully retire until he's actually dead. So let's move on from depressing allegories about the grieving process to, I think, might actually also be allegories for the grieving process, the ritualistic murders and meta storytelling.
It definitely is, in a very weird way.
I know what this is.
So,
yeah.
So you had asked me the last time we recorded why I didn't talk about Alan Wake 2, because you expected me to. And it was because I was like literally at the very end, and it had been like weeks since we'd recorded, and I had so much to talk about that I was like, I'm going to wait until I finish it. And weirdly enough, that night I did finish the game after we had done the recording.
Oh, cool. Fuck yeah.
And so Alan Wake 2 is the sequel to Alan Wake, and it's took 13 years for us to finally get, and I'm not even going to say closure, because the way this ends kind of pissed me off.
Oh, okay.
Because it pissed me off in that, like, there's going to be a third one, or at least to be a third one.
They incorporate way too much of the Control stuff for it not to at least be, like, something else coming in that universe, you know what I mean? Like, there's no way they're done with it. Steve hasn't finished it yet, so anyway, I'm jumping ahead, but...
And they can't leave it here, because it literally stops mid-something.
Oh,
and
fuck
I was like,
that.
No!
What happens? I hate when...
No! Ugh,
so annoying.
But, so, Alan Wake is... The original Alan Wake, I talked about it on Little Cuts back in October... but it's basically a story of a writer that went to Bright Falls, which is this kind of Twin Peaks-esque town. And when he goes there, his wife gets sucked into the lake and he dives in after her. And then we're in this like waking nightmare of like darkness and light. By the end of that game, he is stuck in this dark world and he's trying to write himself out of it. And Alan Wake 2 takes place 13 years later when some man crawls out of the Cauldron Lake, which is the big lake in Bright Falls, and then is ritualistically murdered. And that causes Saga Anderson, who works for the FBI, and her partner, Alex Casey, to come to town to investigate the murder and discover that this is just Saga Anderson, Kate, yep. And find out that this is just the latest in a string of murders that have some similarities. And what I really like about this is that we're following Saga in this story she investigates. And then at a certain point in the game, we get to play as both Alan Wake and Saga in their own storylines that are happening pretty much, it seems like pretty much simultaneously. I'm going to say it pretty much because I want to leave it a little vague in what's happening. But what I really like playing as Saga is that since she is like an FBI person and she is focusing on investigation, she has this a trick that we've seen in a lot, like in, I believe in Hannibal, with like the mind palace type thing. So she has this mind place where she has like, it's like a visual recreation of her office, and she has a case board. And as you get new evidence for the case board, you actually are physically putting it on the board and drawing like correlations. And it's
cool.
Fun way of like figuring out the story. And then there's, like, profiling segments where there's, like, a little supernatural element where she is, like, mentally profiling people. Because, again, this is in the Control universe, so there are some weird supernatural abilities that are going on. And so we're following her as she's trying to figure out who's killing these people and why. And then we're also playing as Alan, who is trying to escape the dark place by rewriting scenes. And his gimmick is that he finds, like, scenes and he is able to go to a storyboard and change the events of the story to, like, change the actual gameplay. And so there's some really interesting things going on here. But then on top of that, it is a very meta story. Like, Sam Lake, he is the director of the game. I believe he's like the owner of Remedy Entertainment, the company that makes the game. He's been the face of Max Payne, like they used his face in the original yes, Max Payne games.
I love it.
And Alex Casey, Saga's partner, looks just like Max Payne, aka looks just like Sam Lake. And so we have that going on here. He's inside the game, but then also there's a lot of live action.
Yes, the FMV sequences. Stuff is so fucking cool. Again, I'm watching Steve play this because he bought it, and I was like, it's been like the one game where I'm like, don't play it if I'm not there. Like, I want to be able, like, yes. I want to watch and like see everything happen. And the FMV stuff is so fucking cool how they incorporated. I won't spoil anything, but like, I was stoked when it hit that point, and I was like, are you joking?
One of the first sequences, I'm not gonna spoil many of them, but I do want to talk about this first sequence where when you first start to play as Alan Wake. It starts as he is like in the green room of some talk show, and he is seeing himself on the TV live action. So the live action is on the TV as you're playing the video game character of him, and you watch it, and then all of a sudden you were watching like the live action interview, and he is so confused as to what's going on. And Sam Lake, aka the director of Remedy, is a guest on this show at the same time. So we have him as like playing Alex Casey, which is sort of like a Max Payne stand-in while also being in the game as himself in live action. There's just some like really fun, weird meta storytelling going on here. And there's a 15-minute segment that involves live action. Sam Lakeception. Yes, Kate. Sam Lakeception. There's this 15-minute segment that just had me smiling. I love how campy and weird this game gets. It surprised me at how campy it is willing to go and how silly it is able to go while also being a story about Alan Wake trying to deal with darkness that is inside of him, as well as trying to figure out what's going on with his wife that he tried to save at the end of it. And there's a whole lot of like dealing with grief in terms of his own character within this. And it's a fascinating game. I want to play it again just because like I want to experience the story and really think about it, because there's so much going on. And I really think it's Remedy Entertainment's best game. I can't wait for another one. I love it.
Hell yeah.
I love it.
Cool. Yeah, Steve hasn't finished it yet, but I'm really into it. I think what's been frustrating for him, what I've seen, is like the mechanics are not as bad as I know they have been in the past, but it's like some of the mechanics are a little janky, it seems like.
Yeah.
A lot of like focusing on storytelling more than storytelling over like, not that the game design is bad or like game the mechanics. Actual like mechanics are bad, but I think like you can tell that how much they care about the story and how that maybe there's a little bit of like there's a discrepancy between this like the storytelling skills and the development of the mechanics and like the difficulty curves for some of the boss fights.
Oh, I dropped it to easy because one of the very first encounters with like a pair of wolves kept killing me.
Oh my God.
Over and over again. Yeah. I was like, it's so frustrating. I was like, you know what? I'm dropping the difficulty down because I died so many times at that one encounter. I do think that on a gameplay side, this game is not as great as like Control. Control is fun to play. Yeah,
I've gotten the shotgun. Okay, because Steve didn't get the shotgun at first, and he tried to do a boss fight, and he couldn't do it, and it was because he didn't get the shotgun. So he had to, like, reload. Yeah. Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, and I think, especially coming from, like, Control, which is their last game before Alan Wake 2, where it's, I think the gameplay in that is really good, and the story kind of takes a little bit of a backseat to the gameplay. This is, like, the reverse of that, and I do think that the gameplay is not as good, but I also think, I don't think the gameplay in Alan Wake, like replaying the first game, was very good, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And this one is an improvement on it, but also I preferred it when I didn't have to shoot monsters.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's really funny how Twin Peaks-y, they really just really go full Twin Peaks in this one, where I'm like, they're not even trying to hide it.
No, and I love some of the little narratives, and there's like Night Springs, which is sort of like the Twilight Zone-esque story, like TV show that people watch. And it also kind of reminds me of Twin Peaks with like the soap opera show that people are watching once in a while on that show as well. And so there's like definite Twin Peaks vibes. But Invitation to Love, yes, thank you, Kate. Yep, exactly. So yeah, I think that this is a very fascinating game. I think it is a very mature and smart game in terms of the storytelling. And I really want to see, I really hope it does well, because I need another one. I need it. So that's Alan Wake 2, out now on PlayStation, Xbox, and PC. Fascinating narratives.
Yes. So this is a book I also read while I was in Japan that I was really surprised by. It's called Revenge by Yoko Ogawa. And okay. It is, she's a Japanese writer. And this is a short story anthology, but every piece is somehow linked to each other. And it creates this really interesting, something that always like fascinates me in just like life is, thinking about how like everyone has their own story and how like you are the NPC in someone else's life, basically, like when you're walking down the street. And this mm-hmm. book in a pretty creepy way moves in a similar direction, like has a similar vibe of like every person has their own story and all these weird things connect us, like these very weird instances connect us. And it's hard to describe it because this whole book just has a very off-putting vibe. She writes, Yoko Ogawa writes so well this feeling of foreboding, like nothing outright like terrifying happens, but everything feels like you're on edge. Like something bad is about to okay. happen, but you don't know what it is. It is deeply uncomfortable the way she writes. And I love that. Like it's hard to capture that. And it's like a very uncanny way of writing. And I really, it was a book I read in one sitting because I couldn't put it down because of how interesting it was, how she wove together all of the stories. Like each story, the story that follows the previous one is connected to it somehow, but in a way that you wouldn't expect. And it all kind of comes full circle in this really weird, fucked up, bizarre cycle that involves carrots and finger bones and murder. Yeah. Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah.
Wait, it's called Revenge. Who's the writer?
Yoko Ogawa.
Because, like, I'm going to be honest, that is a very hard name to search for. Revenge yes. book, you know what I mean? Shock.
I know, very. But it's
okay.
I'd heard about this before, and it's like if you're looking for Japanese fiction written by women, which part?
I apparently have the Kindle edition that I bought back in April of 2013. How have I not read this?
Okay. It was named, I think in 2013, was named like one of the best books of the year by NPR.
That's probably why I bought it.
I think, yeah, because it's so bizarre. And just like, it's narrative, and it's really good.
This is hilarious that I own this book and I've never read it.
I love that so much. That you just own it. Yep. Hell yeah. Isn't it great? I do that all the time. I'm like, oh, I bought that.
But that sounds fascinating.
It's really good and just, like, very, like, uncanny, weird. Like, it's horror, but not, like, horror the way you'd expect it to be. It's just, it's a book that's vibes are very hard to describe, but I know that people listening to this podcast will really be into them. So, if you're looking for something, just, like, it's only 162 pages. It's a pretty quick read. So, if you're looking for something to read when you don't want to deal with your family, give this one a shot.
Hell yeah. I'm gonna download it to my Kindle.
Hell yeah. Read it.
It's so wild.
That is incredible. But I want to hear about Indiana Jones in Hell. That's so funny because I was watching Indiana Jones on Pluto yesterday. So
oh well, this is As Above So Below.
Oh my god. Like I knew and I forgot. You know what I mean? Like you know what I mean? Like I found footage, huh?
Yeah, found footage.
Doing a found footage our series found footage that I series. Obviously forgot how to introduce. Cool. Doing this for a long time. Yeah. So
Indiana- I mean, it has been a minute since we've done a series, like since August, September, maybe. It could been.
Yeah,
a minute.
I think you're right because I think it.
It was no. It was before you went to go film.
Yeah, ever since I filmed.
So it's been a minute.
Whew! Yes, wow. Time is fake. Good lord.
But yeah, so we are doing Yeah, it was Final Destination, Kate. That is where we ended on. Yep, Final Destination. But yeah, so we were doing the found footage, and we started with As Above, So Below, the 2014 movie that takes place in the catacombs beneath the streets of Paris. And
by the Dodel Brothers, and I'm wearing the Poughkeepsie Tape shirt, which is appropriate.
You sure are. A movie I've never seen.
We're going to change that. Someday. For some series. I'm not sure which one yet, but it's gonna change. Just, I'm not sure which venue. But you had, so you have seen As Above, So Below before, correct?
I have, okay. Yes. And I think I saw it, I think this is the third time I've seen it. I remember seeing it when it came out, and I think the problem with this film is timing, because by 2014, it seemed like, yeah. Bad. There was some really bad, like, mainstream found footage films. Like, as I have learned since then, that, like, the best found footage films around this time were a lot of more of the indie stuff. But, like, Hollywood went hard on found footage. And by the time this one came out, I think there was, like, mainstream found footage fatigue. And I remember not really caring for this one. And then I remember watching it again. I want to say it was back in 2018 or so, somewhere around there, and being like, oh, this is actually very interesting and has some very cool things that it's doing, particularly with, like, the idea of cosmic horror and, like, surreal imagery and just, like, the imagination on screen in terms of, like, some of the creepiness that's happening towards the end of this movie is wild. It's wild. I found myself really enjoying it a whole lot more than I expected. I did, and the reason why I did put Indiana Jones in hell is that it made me laugh, because I always forget that this movie opens with our main character Scarlett in Iran trying to, like, find some statue or something.
Yeah, the statue and, like, with the code keeps, of, like, where, it's, like, basically, like, the code of where to find the stone.
The Philosopher's Stone, yeah. It reminded me, it was like, oh, this is basically Indiana Jones as a found footage film that gets fucked up by the end of it. And yeah, I don't know. I've really enjoyed it. I think I forgot that Ben Feldman is in this, and I think he is such a cutie.
Okay, he's like the cute, nerdy love interest / dork who lives in the bell towers of a church. Like, it's always like the dork who's like the Hunchback of Notre Dame. You know what I mean? Like, but he's so cute. So, I saw this movie for the first time, actually, at the beginning of the pandemic. And this was the movie that, like, reignited my love for found footage. Like, fully reignited it. Because I'd always loved found footage, but, like, I hadn't done the deep dive. And this was a movie, like, towards the beginning of quarantine, where I was like, I've never seen this. Like, this looks, like, fun. I've heard good things about it. Like, Tomb Raider found footage. Like, let's fucking go. Like, why not? We're stuck in the house. And then after I watched it, I just, like, was like, my mind has been blown. I can't wait to watch more found footage movies. Like, this is such a fascinating topic and, like, how it's been done. And I think I had, like, thought it wasn't, like you said, it didn't really get a lot of buzz when it came out. And it didn't get a lot of attention at first. But, like, it's incredibly effective and creepy and fucked up and smart. And it's one of the only found footage movies where we have a lot of people survive. It's not just
that's what I was realized on this watch. It's not
just found footage of a bunch of dead people, but people survive. And it's actually like a quasi happy ending. And also, like, a woman is the voice of this whole thing. And it's got, like, that Blair Witch vibe of, like, the woman in charge and she's, like, going too far. But they give her even more depth than this one. Like, and I think you understand her motivations even more. But they really push the found footage budget so, so well in terms of what they're able to accomplish visually and, like, in terms of fear. It's so good and so impressive in what it's doing and how it's constructing this idea of, like, historical documentary and then her ego fueling that, and also kind of talking about a little bit about, like, imperialism and that kind of thing. And it's also just so smart in how it handles religious horror. We don't see religious horror like this. And this is, like, technically religious horror. Like, you could say it's not, but there is a lot of religious horror, but it's not.
I mean, it's based on Dante's Inferno.
Yeah, but it's not the typical religious horror you see. And If you haven't seen the Australian found footage movie The Tunnel, there are a lot of similar vibes. Not in like top, you left before but we could see The Tunnel at Unnamed Footage.
Yeah, Festival, I couldn't, right? I could not see it so, when it hit the festival. I really want to see that though.
Their stories are not the same, but like the trapped in the tunnels and like only seeing things with your flashlight and not knowing like what is going on. Very similar vibes of claustrophobia.
I mean, some of this was giving me Descent vibes.
Yeah.
In terms of like, particularly the moment when they're crawling over bones and the tunnel kind of collapses behind them. I was like, the claustrophobia in this was giving me Descent feel.
Yeah.
I also think it's interesting that this team did the Poughkeepsie tapes. Poughkeepsie tapes. And then would go on to do Quarantine, which we did cover on the podcast. It was a very weird episode. And then Quarantine 2. And then this one. And so it's weird to me to see that because I did not like Quarantine. And yet this one is such a strong film.
Well, and I think it's because they were like allowed to do their own ideas. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like it's so hard to adapt Wreck because Quarantine is just like shot for shot Wreck, but not.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it's hard to make Wreck better. Like, how do you improve upon or like make Wreck any different other than having like the weird post 9/11 vibes to it? But I think with where they shine is when they're able to be really fucking weird and be fucked up.
Yeah.
And like go to these really weird parts of what found footage can be. And they hit two very different ends of the spectrum with the Poughkeepsie tapes and As Above, So Below. But I think it's really cool to see how they think about found footage and how to capture it. And is it Perdita Weeks? Is that her name? She's incredible as Scarlett.
Like, she is really good. Mm-hmm.
Love her as Scarlett. I love a good female found footage lead who like has. I think that's the thing I like about this movie as well as the characters. Like they really try to give you characters to like, and I think a lot of found footage movies don't do a great job at that.
True.
And I think it's so important with this format especially to get to know your characters and to get to, like have sympathy for them and see them as people, and this movie really gets to that, I think, especially with Scarlett and understanding like why she is the way she is.
So this was an enjoyable revisit for me, and I love some of the images. Like I was writing about like the when in my notes there's like statues coming out of the wall and one of them like moves and tears the throat out of George. There's like hands coming out of the bloodstream. There's just like there's this one very striking image of feet that are just sticking out of the ground.
Oh, it's so good. And it's just like
there's so many moments like that that I'm just like, okay, yeah, I'm really vibing with the what the fuck is happening vibe of this last half.
Well, and I also love this interpretation of hell. Like this is not a hell we see. This is like a very kind of, it's like anticlimactic. It's literally just like a hole in the ground and it's cold, dark rocks, but then just tormented souls. And I think it's also making you confront all of your sins over and over again. And I think it is such a smart depiction of hell and depiction of how you get into hell. And I think, it plays with these ideas of alchemy and things we've heard about before, but makes it feel so fresh. And, again, utilizing the found footage format, not necessarily in, like, a super original way, but in a very smart way. And I think that's what is so good about it, is they really understand how to make a found footage movie. It's definitely, I don't know if underrated is the right word, but it's almost underrated in terms of how it almost got left behind and that, like, the post-found footage boom.
I mean, I would say it's definitely underrated because, like, on the critics' side, it had a 28% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Really?
And on the cinema score for, like, the audience, they gave it a C-. And cinema score is one of those weird audience-pulling things where it's, like, a lot of times it's just a scale of did the audience get what they were expecting? And I'm like, what were you expecting from a movie that is literally about going under the catacombs of Paris and exploring hell? Like, what were you... Because, like, I feel like that should have been a higher rating for audiences because you get literally what the movie's advertising itself to be. So it's not like it's a bait and switch type thing.
No.
So I don't know. I don't get it. The critics, I can understand just because I do think that there was a lot of found footage fatigue. And so I think critics, particularly at that time where there wasn't probably as many horror critics
in
the Rotten Tomatoes sphere, were just like, ugh, it's another found footage film, and just wrote it off, is probably, unfortunately, what happened. So yes, yeah. I do think it is underrated. I think that is an appropriate use for this movie.
Okay, fair enough. But yeah, no, I agree that there weren't as many like horror-dedicated people, I think, reviewing at that point. So it was easier for these kinds of things to get written off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It does seem more well-regarded.
It's well-regarded in horror spheres, you know? Like, it's got that reappraisal from found footage people. But yeah, it's definitely, like, has, like, culty status around it.
Yeah.
I think. Cool. Well, I'm so sorry. So that about does it for this week's Little Cuts. But we are continuing our found footage series next week. I'm very excited because I am finally making Terry watch Cronenwood, which is one of my all-time favorite found footage movies. Does a lot of really interesting stuff with flipping the script on sexual assault, especially male sexual assault. So some trigger warnings for that.
Oh.
And playing with like POV on camera and consent. It's very, very good. I'm very excited for you to watch it.
Interesting.
Because I think it is incredibly smart.
And listeners, if you want to follow along with us, it is streaming on Tubi.
Yes, it is streaming for free in a bunch of places. So check it out. It's really good. And then, Terry, who are we talking to on Sunday?
Oh my god. So we recorded this last night, finally. We had a couple of speed bumps getting this to happen. But it happened, and we chatted with Anna Zlokovic, who is the writer and director of Hulu's Appendage, and she is an absolute delight.
Yes.
And she brought with her Eraserhead.
Yeah, and it's fun.
To let you know, the laugh that escaped my body unbidden at one point in this conversation, this one is for the books. This one is probably one of my favorites that we've recorded for a while, just because of how...
I have a fan theory that gets a little out of hand. So
it was so good. I've been laughing about it all day.
Yeah,
so I can't wait to share this one. Yeah, and so after you listen to the episode, you'll understand the gift that I attached to that tweet if you go back and look at the tweet.
Not the song. Anyway, get excited.
It's a good one.
It's
so,
good one. Yeah.
Yes.
All right, listeners. Oh, my goodness. Jesus, you heard from us. We want to hear from you. Did you watch a film, read a book, or played one of the games, or played the game we talked about this week? Do you have suggestions for our next series? You can let us know by sending us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com or reaching out to us on social media. I am at MB McAndrews on Twitter and Blue Sky, and MB.McAndrews on Instagram.
And I'm at Gailey Dreadful everywhere.
And of course, don't forget to follow the podcast on socials at Scarred Podcast on Twitter and Blue Sky, and at Scarred for Life Podcast on Instagram.
And please don't forget to review, rate, and subscribe. And we will be opening up Patreon again soon. So if you want to help support us, that would be lovely.
Woo! Thank you to Eric Parr for our artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Please stay safe out there. But most importantly, stay creepy.
And until next time.